The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So I'd like to continue a little bit on the theme that I did last week that is inspired by the divisiveness of public speech in our society these days and some of the ways in which speech is referred to and discussed. And I think for many people who are following the news, some of the statements about truth that are coming out stand out quite dramatically. That the president's lawyer should say that truth is not truth. At least on the surface of those four words, it's a little bit noteworthy and I think begs for further investigation and consideration and what in the world the person was saying in saying that. Statements about the tremendous, onslaught of claims about fake news certainly requires more reflection and consideration of what's being said and why and the impact of it. And statements from the president that said that what you read and what you see are not what's happening. And that's kind of also requires some consideration what's actually meant there. So the idea that some of these public statements now require further consideration, both for what was being said, and the intention and the impact, but also the whole nature of truth and what is true and how do we know, is a topic that's up for us to consider as a society. And some of the moral relativism that exists in our society and that's often overall is associated more with a liberal left than the right, is spilling over now and in some ways coming back and biting the liberal left with moral relativism that seems to be coming out of other parts of our society now. So it's a complicated issue, what's going on, and we're looking at it, people to understand it. So I thought I would try to look a little bit at the topic of truth today in this talk. And I can confidently say that I don't feel like I'm an expert at this topic in the degree to which it's required in our consideration. So these are both my exploration of it, but also because I don't feel like I really understand these issues as much as well as they should be, what I can do is go back to the suttas, the teachings of the Buddha, and see how that's handled there, and see if that might have some relevance for our modern consideration, reflection on these topics. And so there's a number of things. So I want to read relate to you one of my favorite discourses, favorite little texts from the ancient tradition that purport to be the teachings of the Buddha. And it has to do with a conversation the Buddha had with a young Brahmin. And in the Buddhist text, the version of the story, he's a little bit too presumptuous or a little bit too proud or something and kind of a little bit rude to the Buddha. And so the Buddha at some point thinks, well, let's give him a chance to ask a question or give him a chance to speak to me. And so he does. And this Brahmin belongs to the priest class of the Brahmanical religions of ancient India. And they believed a set of scriptures goes back some thousands of years before that even, the Vedas and the Upanishads and different texts that they have. And so this Brahmin says to the Buddha, these scriptures that we have, in some Brahmins claim are true. Is it true? He says, some Brahmins come to the conclusion, only this is true. Only our scriptures are true, and others are empty or worthless, depending how you translate the word moga. And I find it kind of very interesting that it's the distinction being made here is not between truth and falsehood, but between truth and what's empty or useless or worthless. So are these scriptures? So some people say this, and what does the Buddha think about this? Is it true or worthless, these teachings? Yes. So this Brahmin asks the Buddha, you know, he says, what do you think of this statement that these Brahmins have come to the conclusion only this is true and everything else, you know, is worthless? And the Buddha then asks a question in return. He says, any of the Brahmins who exist today, who are currently alive, have they known and seen these truths for themselves? And he says, no, they haven't actually seen and known them for themselves. And then the Buddha asks, well, has any of the people, has their teachers, maybe no longer alive, have they known and seen this for themselves? No. And then if you go back 7 generations of teachers into the past, have any of those teachers seen and known these things for themselves as being true? And the Brahmin says, no. So in other words, the claim, truth claims, the claim these scriptures are true, is based on the scriptures themselves, not because anyone that they know has actually seen and known this. And I don't know what to think of what the Buddha says next, I kind of would like to believe he said this with great kindness and compassion and gentleness, but you know, you can read it as you wish. But he said, well, that's a little bit like a line of blind people, you know, holding hands, leading each other along. They can't see, they don't know where they're going, but, you know. So anyway, that's what the text says. And then the Buddha said, well, and so what, they're just relying, these are all things that they're holding, believing on faith. So these are faith claims that these scriptures are true. So that, and faith is a powerful influence on people's lives and what they believe, what they hold to, but so that's based on faith. So then this Brahmin says to the Buddha, it's not only out of faith that they believe this, but also because they honor or revere their scriptures. So then the Buddha says, kind of changes the direction of the conversation a little bit, and he says this. He says, first, you took a stand on faith. Now you speak about scripture. There are 5 things that may turn out in 2 different ways here and now. What 5? Faith, taking things on faith, on your personal liking and disliking, based on scripture, based on reasoning, and based on consideration and pondering of views. So there's these 5 ways in which people can relate to, here we're talking about religious teachings, but you can take it on faith, you can take it, you can accept it or believe in it because you just like it. You can believe it because it's the tradition, the scriptures of the tradition, and that makes it true. You can take it on because you've really reasoned it out this for yourself. Or you, not quite like reasoning, but you've really given consideration and then accepting it out of consideration. So, you know, the last 2 is, you know, many people have a lot of value and who are very rational, like to rationally think things out. And so the Buddha said these 5 ways. And then he says that these 5 ways may turn out in 2 different ways. Something may be fully accepted out of faith, yet it may be empty, hollow, and false. Yet, it might also be, someone might also accept it out of faith, and it might be factual, true, and unmistaken. And then he goes through all five of these. And he says, the fact that it's taken on faith or taken on just because of scripture or these other reasons doesn't determine whether it's false or true. That in itself, because it can turn out either way by them. So that's not quite good enough for the Buddha. And so then this Brahmin says, then the Buddha continues and he says, under these conditions, the fact that these five different criteria for truth are not, you know, can turn out either way, someone who is interested in preserving the truth would not come to the definitive conclusion, only this is true and anything else is empty or worthless. So Buddha introduces this idea of someone who's interested in preserving the truth. So that gets the Brahmin's attention. And he says, how do you preserve the truth? And that's a little bit different than yet in saying what is the truth, but how do you preserve the truth? And this next answer is one that I cherish a lot. Buddha says, you preserve the truth. If you take something on faith, you say so. It's my faith that this is true. As opposed to saying this is true, it's my faith. It's my faith to rely on the scriptures. It's my faith to rely on my likes, what I like or dislike. The basis upon which I take what something to be true, the basis is on faith. The basis is on scripture. The basis is on what I like, my preferences. The basis is on my reasoning, my pondering. So people know exactly why and how you're taking this to be true. You're not claiming it is true. You're confessing why you take it as true, or the basis of authority upon which you take it to be true. And if you make that statement, then you're preserving the truth. You're making an honest statement. To say that some religious teaching is absolutely true and everything else is false, that may or may not be true. But to say, that I'm taking this on faith, I'm taking this because my scriptures teach me so, that is preserving the truth. Then you're being honest about it. And one of the nice things about it, then it's easier for people to know where you're coming from. It's easier to be in dialogue with people. It's easier to kind of explore the value or the appropriateness of those sources of authority that people have. And what you find in this ancient Buddhist tradition is, in fact, a questioning of the authority upon which people take or hold religious views, and which we find in the Buddhist texts. There's often then, as a result of that, a kind of pulling the rug from underneath many people's beliefs, not because they're criticizing the beliefs, because they're questioning the underlying source of authority for why people hold to those beliefs. Does that make sense? Anyway, so this is how you preserve the truth. So this Brahmin comes back with another question then. And he says, so he agrees, yes, in this way there's the preservation of truth. But in what way is there the discovery of truth? So it's one thing to preserve the truth by making a statement about why you believe something. But now we just get down to truth itself. How do you discover what's true, as opposed to just these sources? So I think the idea is discover it for yourself. How do you really know the truth? And So back then in ancient India, there were no books, written books. There was no TV, no news, editorials, all kinds of things. There was an oral tradition, and it was all done orally. And so so you really required a person-to-person contact to learn anything or consider anything. And so it was very important then to go to some, if you wanted to find the truth, and if you weren't going to completely rely on yourself, and to kind of, you go around and ask people, what do you think, and what are your teachings, you had to, you'd go to someone. So the Buddha said, when you go to someone to begin investigating what might be true, the first thing you should do is discover if that person is free of greed, hate, and delusion. Because if they're not, you can't quite rely that, depend on that what they're going to say is really going to be true. They're going to be skewed in some way or influenced in some ways of what they say. And the way the Buddha says this, he says, you should go to a person and investigate the person, to check the person out. In another text, he says, if you go to a religious teacher, take your time. Check them out really well. So investigate the person in regard to three kinds of states. In regard to states based on greed, hatred, and delusion. And ask yourself, are there in this person any one of these states such that that person's mind will be obsessed? And while not knowing better, might say something that is false. And while not knowing, the person might say, I know. And while not seeing, the person might say, I see. So a person makes truth claims, but have influenced by greed, hate, and delusion, they might not say what actually is true in terms of what they know and see. Or, and the next one's very interesting, or that person might urge others to act in a way that would lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. So the statements that we make, the truth claims we make, can have huge consequences. And we want to be careful with those consequences that they don't perpetuate harm in our society. And, here it says for a long time. And so when you want to check out someone for what they say, here it's not so much do they say the truth, but what's the quality, what's the character of the speaker? Is this a truthful speaker? Is this a trustworthy speaker that you're hearing? So that was a kind of interesting So here we're not looking at what is true and false in terms of doctrine or teachings or something like that. But first and foremost, we're looking at the ethical qualities of the speaker. And that's an interesting criteria. And you find that over and over again in the teachings of the Buddha, the ethical qualities of the speaker, of the person, needs to be evaluated, not just the abstract claims of truth and false about something. Now, one of the reasons for this in the Buddhist tradition is that it has to do with the ways in which the Buddha then spoke, that how a person can discover the truth for themselves. And that's what he's going to go through here. So first you go check out the teacher, and then you listen to the teacher, and then you ponder and reflect on what the teacher says. And when after you've reflected on it and thought about it for a while, then you put it into practice. And so for the Buddha, the truth the Buddha was interested in was not propositional truths, were not claims that you had to take on faith, but rather something you can discover for yourself. And so, I don't know if pragmatic truth is the right word for it, but experiential truth in some way. And what is it that you can reliably know for yourself? Because it's very easy for people to say, this is my experience, and think it's their real personal experience, direct experience, but there's such a strong overlay of interpretations that go on top of how we perceive and see and understand what's going on, that it's not really a direct experience. It's being seen through the filter of interpretations and bias already. So for the Buddha, then he goes on and talks about practicing, and by practicing, and for the Buddha, he gives in many places a path of practice that includes meditation to discover the truth. And one of the interesting things to realize here is that if you want to discover the truth that the Buddha was pointing to, the path to do so goes through a phase where you have to become a person who's not being influenced by greed, hatred, and delusion, and in any kind of way. And so this is an ethical transformation that the individual... Influenced by greed, hatred, and delusion. So the person who, if you want to discover the kind of truth, experiential truth, the Buddha was, encouraging people to do, we have to go through a phase of practice where our own greed, hatred, and delusion, maybe it hasn't been eradicated completely, but meditation, we're able to put it at rest or put it aside or settle it down enough that our eyesight, our ability to know and see, are not going to be unduly influenced by greed, hate, and delusion. And more importantly, we're going to able to see without that agitation that greed, hate, and delusion would bring on. So here, before we even get to what is the truth, in the Buddha's language, we're talking about the ethical state of the person who speaks the truth and also the person who's going to discover it for themselves. That there is no discovery of the truth unless somehow or other we're able to work on this inner obscurations and confusions and drives and biases that come from greed, hatred, and delusion. And then with that, it's possible to see the truth that the Buddha was pointing to. And that truth, again, could be said to be very ethical in nature because it involves the eradication, the uprooting of these three ethical states, these motivating states, greed, hatred, and delusion. And those get uprooted, and it's possible to see or experience the mind or the heart absent of these states. It's possible to experience them temporarily absent. And for some people, that's a radical experience to really feel this purity or this cleanliness inside. And even people who conventionally don't have much greed, hatred, and delusion, you know, it's not really... For Buddhists to keep talking about greed, hatred, and delusion, they fall asleep because it's not quite so interesting, you know, what's this about? But once you start following a path of meditation where the mind gets cleaner and cleaner because the activity, the agitations of the mind are quieting down, that experience of the mind being clean can be radically transformative for people to know that that's possible. And then after that, the tendencies of the mind to get back into all those activities that fit the category of greed, all the activities that fit the category of hatred, of delusion, it just doesn't feel right anymore because you know a different way. So that's a discovery of truth. Again, that's not a propositional truth. It's more of a psychological experience, a state that a person knows for themselves. And they know this hurts to have these unethical states, and these don't hurt to have the opposites. And this language of ethics that I'm using, some people don't appreciate it, which is reasonable for many reasons. But in the ancient India, there was no obvious word for our word ethics. And so the Buddha doesn't say that it's important to be ethical. He just says, greed, hate, and delusion have to, need to be addressed and looked at and be cleansed from. And but for many people here, in many Western perspectives, this could be seen as an ethical path, an ethical change that happens with people. And exactly what the truth is, aside from this kind of experiential truth and this kind of taste of freedom that can come from the absence of these states of clinging, I don't, you know, that's, you know, gets more and more complicated in our society and what goes on around us. But do we listen to people who are, you know, being, you know, really being driven by what seems like greed and hatred and clearly attempts to be deceitful, and what influences? The Buddha was concerned about the long-term harm that things cause, and so this public discourse that happens in our country right now, it might be interesting to consider that in 2017 there were 81 journalists who were murdered around the world. And some 280 of them who were put in jail. And, you know, a lot of them were investigating corruption in different kinds of ways. And this prosecutor who was just prosecuting the case of Paul Manafort, some, I don't know, 10, 12 years ago, maybe some of you remember exactly how long ago, he was, apparently the New York Mafia had a whole plan to assassinate him in a restaurant in New York City. So how people speak about journalists and news is not inconsequential. And so what is the motivation behind why people speak, and what is the impact we have? Would be a very important Buddhist reflection on all this. And people certainly have very important things they're trying to accomplish, and maybe purposes they feel very motivated to do. But in Buddhism, nothing justifies acting from places of greed, hatred, and delusion. So in Buddhism, the task would be, if you really feel passionate about something, you don't succumb to those forces, but you'd find other important and creative ways, significant ways, to speak up and to work and institute change. So then I'd like to end with this two quotes from the suttas. And that one's not from the suttas, from a later Theravadan commentary. Truthfulness has the characteristic of non-deceptiveness. I love this definition. It's a little bit hard to know what's true. I'd like to propose that it's easier to know what's deceptive. And so we might be at a hard time sometimes, you know. So we never want to say what's false. Maybe that can be more easily ascertained in many situations, the things people claim. And so it's one thing to make a claim that something, you know, it's one thing is to lie. It's another thing to, you know, to say this is true. And lying is that, you know, is so non-lying is the definition of truth. So that's, you know, I think that's really interesting. The second quote: when one is not ashamed of telling a deliberate lie, there is no evil than one would not do. That quote is from the Buddha. So you know, what is truth? What is falsehood? How do we discover it for ourselves? How do we preserve it? By being careful about how we hold what we say, how we make claims. And do we make claims that we tell people, it's on this basis that I make this claim. I read it in the news. You know, I read it in, you know, you say where you read it, you know, and where you heard it. And then people can then participate in a deeper reflection of what's going on than they can if you just make claims. So that was my offering to, you know, a topic which I don't think as I said earlier, I don't feel like I have a good sense of how to find my way in the world of these truth claims that exist out in the world in many different fronts. But I think that I say that I'm still trying to find my way with it, because I think as a society, it really is good for all of us to spend some time reflecting and thinking, you know, how does this work? And it's very easy to be opinionated, so that's not true, and how could they? But not really take a good look. What do we believe? What do we understand? And how do we have really looked and considered the nature of truth and falsehood and truth claims and right now I think the a lot of the public discussion around this that I've been seeing around the words facts and truth. And if that's the only words or concepts that are used in this discussion, it's actually, I think, kind of poor and limited. And it might be important to introduce other words into the conversation, and that is concepts of the values that people have, and also the principles that people base their lives on. Because values and principles don't really fit neatly into truth and falsehood claims. And they don't fit into facts, non-fact kind of claims. And so, but they're very important in human society. The principles that our society is based on, or community, or people, and the values they're based on. So to be reflection and think about the difference between truth, facts, values, and principles is an important part of this whole exploration, important part of our society these days. So that's the talk. And it is true, and it's a fact, and it's a value and a principle that we should try not to park on Birch Street. And the parking lot across the street. What? Oh, and also in the dentist parking lot there, that's the other place. So... So some things luckily, fit the bill, all four of those. Yes?
So you talked about greed, hatred, and delusion.
Yes.
You talked about greed, hatred, and delusion, the three hindrances. So greed and hatred is a little bit easier to understand.
Mm-hmm.
Delusion has a lot of grades and, the subtleties of biases that can come in and can lead to delusion.
And the problem with delusion is that it can be, it's hard to see it, that it's, we think it's fact or true, right? And it's that's the challenge with delusion, is to know how to see it. But there's plenty of delusions that are easier to see than others, and sometimes it's only the next day we realize. But that's pretty good. Well, what was I thinking? But a lot of it. One way to think of it that may be helpful is to consider it to be projections. We project ideas, values, concepts, interpretations on the world around us and other people. And it's actually possible to watch the birth of those projections if the mind is mindful enough, strong enough. And the ability to watch a thought arise in the mind, a perception, perceptions are not innocent in Buddhism, they're kind of a thought, to see kind of the stance, the assumptions that arise when we see someone or see a situation, and watch it happen. Allows us to evaluate it and see, well, that's not really true, or that's not really, I'm not so sure about it. What happens when thoughts and interpretations and ideas arise and we're not mindful of it, then it gets completely intertwined with our perceptions of reality itself. And so it seems like what we're seeing is, we don't see that our perception and our interpretations are entangled, or that they're two separate things. And so the ability to be calm, centered, and mindful is one of the best antidotes to a lot of delusions. Whether it works for all, You know, sometimes it takes a lot of deep inner work. And so that's why the reference point for the Buddha to really do this deep work of putting aside greed, hate, and delusion, his path is to do meditation. The meditative mind is one of the best platforms to do this, to see this. If you're trying to do it without meditating, it might be very limited how far you can go. So it is time to stop, and I appreciate this question. This is a very important topic, and probably we should have more discussion, but I don't want to keep people here. But I want to say that please stay for the potluck, and please say hello to each other and welcome each other here, and if this was an evocative talk, you might share with some person next to you or something a little bit about what your thoughts are in listening to this. Thank you.